We are talking today with William Hartung. William Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His writings have appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. He is also author of several books, including And Weapons for All, How Much Are You Making on the War, Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration. And he is here to talk about his latest book, Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, Profits of War?
Well, I had worked on these issues going back to the late Carter administration. And it seemed like every time I turned around, there was Lockheed Martin. You know, whether it was the arms trade, whether it was missile defense in the 90s, they were at the forefront of the merger boom that actually created Lockheed Martin from two separate companies. You know, and then I learned going back that they were involved in some of the most interesting sort of influence peddling and corruption scandals, as well as being cutting edge in some of the technology. So it seemed like just a sort of too interesting to pass up, given my, you know, background in the subject and my interest in, you know, finding a new way at it.
All right. So tell us about the history of Lockheed Martin, starting with their beginnings, if you would.
Well, it started out with two brothers, Alan and Malcolm Lockheed, who originally spelled their name L-O-U-G-H-E-A-D, which was pronounced Lockheed, but a lot of people were calling Alan Lughead, and so he decided to change the spelling of the name to the current spelling, L-O-C-K-H-E-E-D. But it took him about 30, 40 years to do that, so I guess he got a lot of Lughead this and Lughead that before he finally decided it was time for the change. But the two brothers were kind of early aviation enthusiasts. Alan learned to pilot a plane around 1910, 1912, you know, less than a decade after the Wright brothers' first flight. Malcolm was interested in the auto industry and learned some skills there that they applied to making aircraft. So their first plane was used to fly basically tourists and, you know, thrill seekers around the San Francisco Bay, and they built it in a garage in San Francisco. And that was how they made their initial capital, was $5 or $10 a pop, just flying people around San Francisco Bay, including at a major Pacific exposition where they had lost the contract, but the other, the competitor crashed his only plane. And so they sort of by forfeit ended up getting that concession.
All right. And where did it go from there? How did they get involved with doing military stuff?
Well, originally, they kind of steered clear of it, and there wasn't a lot to be had. They sort of missed the World War I procurements because they only started in 1916, and they didn't have anything ready to really sell to the military. So after that, there wasn't a lot of business to be had. In fact, Malcolm got fed up and went into the auto industry permanently, created a hydraulic brake system that became the industry standard for quite a while. But, you know, by 1918, 1919, his nerves couldn't take it. You know, they didn't have the business. They were on the verge of bankruptcy. And all through the 20s, they were trying to build planes for transport or for the post office. And then in the 30s, finally, they were bought by a financier named Robert Gross, who, you know, initially also wanted to steer clear of the military. But finally, he wrote to one of his colleagues, you know, we're not going to make it unless we get contracts for war machines. So they started in the mid-30s, and it really picked up when they made the Hudson bomber, which they sold to Britain when Britain was first concerned about Hitler. So in the late 30s, before they sold much to the U.S. government, they became the largest company in the aircraft industry by selling these bombers to the Brits.
But the Brits ended up buying a lot of them.
Oh, yes. Yes, they bought a couple thousand, and it was a huge boon to Lockheed because they were – you know, they had maybe 1,000 or so employees at most in the late 30s. And between the British buys and finally the ramping up of the U.S. war effort, they had 91,000 employees by 1943. So overnight, you know, they just boomed, and they were, you know, short of workers. They were getting using teenagers and out-of-work actors and migrants from the Midwest and South and pretty much anybody they could employ. And, you know, given the circumstances, it's probably surprising that the aircraft were as good as they were, you know, given that these people were just being thrown at this task without a lot of background in what was still, you know, a relatively young field of endeavor.
So World War II winds up, and what happened to them then?
Well, right after the war, it was a crisis in the industry because there actually was substantial demobilization, not just of troops, but also of weapons procurement. And Robert Gross described it as, he said, "I will never forget those short, appalling weeks." And he wasn't talking about the weeks, you know, during the war, which was certainly appalling, but the weeks after the war, when his business dropped precipitously. And so the companies were trying to figure out, you know, how can we get back, if not to World War II levels, at least at a steady level of government spending so we can keep this industry going. And they decided what they needed was some sort of blue ribbon panel that would sort of make the case for a permanent large aircraft and arms industry. And so they lobbied, and Congress created one, as did the Truman administration. So there were two of these. And one of them, the Findlater Commission, became the more influential of the two. And Wayne Biddle, who wrote a very good book on this called Barons of the Sky, pointed out that the Findlater Commission took testimony from 150 witnesses, and 149 of them were involved directly in the aircraft industry, either in the Air Force or in the companies. And there was one guy who was a journalist who was very pro-industry, pro-buildup. So when Robert Gross had been pitching this to Congress, he said, you know, we need a citizens panel that's disinterested, that's just looking at the broader interests of the country, and I'm sure they will come to the conclusion that we need, you know, a larger aircraft industry, more government support for it, for national security, as well as technological, you know, business reasons, giving us a technological edge over other countries. But in fact, it ends up they kind of wired it with this panel that had, you know, 99.9% people who had a self-interest in promoting aircraft as weapons. And so they proposed an 80% increase in the military budget, large increases in Army and Navy aircraft procurement. And this sort of started the thing rolling in the right direction, at least from the point of view of the industry.
So the whole industry benefited from that, not just Lockheed.
Right. And, you know, Gross was one of the more aggressive advocates of the policy, but you know, the head of Douglas Aircraft, the people from Boeing, all the companies weighed in on this, and it was sort of a joint effort. In fact, the they had formed a trade association, the Aircraft Industries Association, which was ended up being headed up by a guy named Oliver Eccles, who had been the head of Army procurement during World War II. So it's kind of the beginning, or at least one of the more prominent cases of the revolving door, where you have somebody who goes from a position in government and then goes into private industry in the same area that they had worked in government, then uses their connections to reach back into the government to try to get their former colleagues to make decisions on behalf of their company. So, you know, so they had a kind of a full court press on this, and, you know, the different companies as well as their trade association pushed vigorously for this blue ribbon panel approach, which they thought would be the best way to sell this buildup to the public.
All right. After World War II, they pull this blue ribbon panel together, and they get the backing on that for funding. What happens after that?
Well, Korea really kind of rescued the industry because there were a lot of things going on. There was the Findlater Commission. There was the long telegram that was the beginning of containment, you know, written by George Kennan, which kind of painted the Soviet Union as this kind of, you know, all-encompassing atheistic power that was going to be pressing against us at every turn all over the world. So these kind of rhetorical and political pushes for a larger arms establishment were not really getting a lot of traction until the war in Korea. Then a lot of that logic sort of came to be integrated into government policy. People like Robert Gross tried to capitalize on that. He gave a speech to the Western Aircraft Manufacturers Association where he said, you know, we need, if we're going to be fighting in places like Korea and elsewhere around the world to defend, you know, our values and defend democracy, we're going to need to move men and materials quickly to all these different places. And to do that, you need fast transport, and you need to do it from the air. So he was making the case for, essentially, if you want to police the globe, you need our products, and you need to give us enough money to make a new generation of these products. So there was the benefits of the war itself, and then there was the way that it was utilized to try to further that notion of a permanent large arms establishment.
And that was the same period when we're really seeing the tail end of World War II, is when the Germans started using jet engines. Was that the same period when America started producing jet engines?
Yeah, it was around the same period. And, you know, they, Lockheed was, you know, they didn't build them themselves. They were produced by other companies. And Lockheed was, you know, built the airframes, and they were sort of the assembler of the final product. But in addition to the, you know, the advent of you know, jet fighters and jet aircraft, they became involved in the missile industry, ballistic missiles, and they built the Polaris submarine launch ballistic missile in the 50s. And by all accounts, they did a good job in the sense of the thing worked, although, of course, thankfully, we never put it to the test in a war. We wouldn't be here talking about this. But and it came in around what it had been estimated to cost, which is, you know, very rare in the annals of military procurement. But it almost didn't get built. There were already three or four other ballistic missile programs, and President Eisenhower was sort of saying, enough is enough already. I mean, how many different ways are we going to go at this? Why don't you take one of the land-based ICBMs, figure out how to use it from a submarine? But ends up that was not really workable because they were so large. You would have to have a massive boat to be able to contain them. And also they were liquid-fueled, which would be kind of very dangerous to do in the confined space of a submarine. So finally, he relented, and they developed this Navy program. And there was an Admiral William Rayburn who was a huge cheerleader for this. He went around the country giving talks about it. He encouraged the companies to do advertising on behalf of it, to go around and you know, have sort of mini pep rallies at their factories. And it was really very different from the World War II approach because, you know, where the government really was kind of the driving force in World War II, this was more of a partnership between the government and industry into trying to promote a weapon system.
I know that Lockheed Martin now is involved with nuclear weapons, at least design. When did they get involved with that? I mean, if they were involved with missile production at some point in time?
It was much later. Basically, a system evolved. You know, originally, the Atomic Energy Commission controlled nuclear weapons work, and they had these facilities around the country that had been built up during the Manhattan Project. And at a certain point, they decided to have private contractors run them instead of them being government-owned facilities. And so this evolved over many years, but it wasn't until, you know, the 90s or so that Lockheed bought into this system when they got the contract to run Sandia Nuclear Weapons Laboratory in New Mexico. And also they had a piece of the work at the nuclear test site in Nevada. So they made a decision that they wanted to be involved in this aspect of the work and essentially, you know, put their names out there to be a manager of one of these labs. But they didn't have to make the initial investment. Essentially, the government had already created this facility, and their job was to manage it, recruit new talent, you know, make the thing work.
Let's go back to the Korean War. Then things expanded there. What happened after that wrapped up?
Well, one of their most successful programs was the U-2 spy plane. And the client for it was the CIA primarily. And they had a secret research facility in the Mojave Desert, which was organized by a young engineer named Kelly Johnson, who is, by their account, the most skilled engineer in the history of the company. And he had helped when he was just out of school build the P-38 fighter. And he had quite exacting standards about how things should be done. And he liked to work with a relatively small team. He wanted the engineers to be close to the factory floor so they could make adjustments on the fly. He rewarded people for, you know, not for how many people worked for them and how big their unit was, but he tried to gauge it to the how productive they were. So it was running against the grain of a lot of what was happening in the industry at that time. And so this facility at first was almost the equivalent of working in a tent. I mean, it was a pretty primitive setup. And it was near what had been a chemical plant. So the smell was so overpowering that they started calling it the Skunk Works. And it was after a cartoon by Al Capp where they had a still that they would make whiskey out of. And they would throw everything under the sun in their old shoes and whatever they could find. And it was spelled S-K-O-N-K in the cartoon, the comic strip. And so they used that spelling until they were sued by Al Capp's publisher. And so they changed it to the traditional spelling. And but anyway, so the Skunk Works was where they built the U-2, which was a very complicated plane. It was supposed to go at such high altitudes and yet be able to be still enough to take photographs that were useful of various Soviet military facilities. And it was did quite a good job, but unfortunately a lot of the information that was gathered was not shared in a way that was useful to the public. I mean, they kept most of it under wraps, even though they knew, for example, there was no bomber gap with the Soviets, there was no missile gap with the Soviets. And so Eisenhower and then Nixon, even though they were getting pounded by Kennedy on this notion of a missile gap, decided not to share that information because it was classified, because they didn't want to reveal too much about their methods of gathering this stuff. But the U-2, you know, if they had used the information in a transparent way, probably could have obviated, you know, some of the beginnings of the nuclear arms race. But it's always the question of how you use the technology, just not what the capability is that it gives you. So, you know, so between that and the Polaris, they really were quite successful in the 50s. They also built the C-130 transport plane, which initially had some problems, but has been a workhorse, which is still used in various variations up to this day, you know, so it's 50 years later. So, it was probably one of their better decades in terms of their management and their being able to produce quality products. But things didn't remain that way, unfortunately.
Was it shortly thereafter that they started producing questionable planes and other projects?
Well, the 60s really was when the problems started to emerge. There was a large transport plane called the C-5, which they started to develop kind of in the early period of the Vietnam War, before the big troop buildups. But the Air Force had decided, much along the lines of what Robert Gross had called for in the 50s, that they wanted to be able to reach anywhere in the globe quickly, move significant amounts of troops and weaponry, and be able to land on unimproved airstrips and, you know, difficult to get to places. And so the C-5 was supposed to achieve all of that. And initially, it didn't look like Lockheed was going to win that bid. There was a advisory panel, a technical panel within the Air Force that chose a Boeing design. But Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, who was a mentor to Lyndon Johnson, who headed the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, basically put his two cents in, and suddenly what had been, going to be a Boeing win turned into a Lockheed win to build this thing. And in later years, the mayor of Marietta, Georgia, which is where the C-5 was built, said, well, you know, Russell, he knew we didn't need that plane, you know, but he knew we needed it, you know, for the good of Georgia. And when it was rolled out on the assembly line, Lyndon Johnson went down and gave a little speech and said, you know, a lot of places would like to have this work, but not everybody has the Georgia delegation. So, you know, the circumstances of its birth, so to speak, were somewhat suspect. I mean, they had political imprints all over them as opposed to a straight competition on the merits. And so they, it ended up that they had cost problems almost from the outset. And part of it was pretty amazing thing they were supposed to build. I mean, it was almost the size of a football field. It was 7 stories high off the ground. It was supposed to have an engine that could, had the power equivalent of powering a city of 50,000 people. And then it was larger than any airliner by a long shot. But it was supposed to be able to land on a strip about half the size of the normal, length you would give for a traditional airliner. So, you know, part of it is the Pentagon asked for things that may not have been doable. But as often happens, the companies, rather than being honest about the fact that this may not be doable, say, hey, I'll go for it. I'll do my best. And then if they figure if they bid a little bit low, they'll get further enough into the program that the government doesn't want to then waste what they've invested. And it's almost like an extortion racket. You know, well, we've gone this far. I mean, we can't pull the plug, can we? You got to give us some more money, a little more money, a little more money, if you want your product. And so on the C-5, the problem was a little more money turned into $2 billion in cost overruns, which was the largest cost overrun in the history of military procurement up to that point. So that was one of their, failures of the 60s. Another was the Cheyenne helicopter, which was supposed to be able to lift up like a helicopter and then fly like a normal plane. And that tripled in cost, never really was able to do its mission. A couple pilots were killed, flying the thing. And finally, it was put out of its misery, but only after about $500 million had been spent, which in those days was real money. You know, whereas now it would be kind of chump change for some of these big companies.
Was there any penalty for the company for, not following through on those contracts?
Well, initially, it wasn't even clear that the Air Force was going to own up to it. They tried to hide the overruns, and they kind of fiddled with the numbers, and they claimed that, the original estimate is not that different from what we're seeing in terms of costs. And part of that was they were just taking some of the costs off the books altogether. The other thing is they changed the baseline. Instead of the original, $2 billion or so that the company had promised, they said, oh, no. They had only promised, $3 to $4 billion initially. So they were playing with the numbers. They were trying to keep Congress in the dark. And, it finally fell to a whistleblower in the Air Force, a cost estimator named Ernest Fitzgerald. And he was keeping an eye on this. And he realized that this thing, the costs were going through the roof, and that it wasn't clear it was going to be able to perform its, promised mission. So he, somewhat reluctantly, I mean, he didn't want to get fired. I mean, he was raising questions about this inside the Air Force, but he testified to Congress when Senator William Proxmire got wind of this, and his superiors did not want him to testify at all, but Proxmire was insistent. So finally they said, you can testify, but don't say anything about the C-5 and don't reveal anything about the C-5. But of course, in his prepared testimony, that was one thing. But once Proxmire started asking him questions, he didn't feel that he could just, kind of stonewall him. So, he said, what's the cost overrun on the C-5? Proxmire said, I hear it's as much as $2 billion. And Fitzgerald said, well, if current trends continue and if the engine increases at the same rate as the airframe and if the spare parts come in at the highest projected levels, then it's conceivable that you might have a cost overrun in that ballpark. So it was a very kind of conditioned statement, partly because he wanted to protect his job. So he didn't just come out and say, you're absolutely right, Senator Proxmire. But it didn't really matter because the way it played in the press was C-5, has $2 billion overrun. And when he came back to his office, his secretary said, have they fired you yet? And they did not fire him, but they demoted him. And eventually they did push him out of the Air Force through some bureaucratic maneuvering. So in terms of consequences for the company, eventually Proxmire did get, he sort of stopped the gravy train at a certain point. So on the first batch of the planes, they had some overruns, and they were going to make it up by charging even more for the second batch. And what Proxmire did was he lobbied in the Congress to keep them from building the full number, that second batch. And he was partially successful. And so they had to eat maybe 400 or 500 million of the $2 billion overrun. But that and the fact that they were having trouble with their airliner, the L-1011, put them in a very precarious spot. So they paid a price, but not as big a price as the taxpayers had to pay for it.
And had that whistleblower not come forward, did you get the sense that either Lockheed or the Air Force would have put a stop to this eventually?
I think it would have gone on much longer, and that eventually they would have been called to account. But it probably would have been after that $2 billion was water under the bridge. So I think Proxmire and Fitzgerald saved the taxpayers, you know, a substantial sum of money. There was also a whistleblower from inside Lockheed, a guy named Henry Durham, and he talked about how it worked in the factory. You know, Fitzgerald talked about kind of the bureaucratic fudging that happened inside the Air Force to cover it up. Durham talked about what it was like in the factories. You know, the fact that, for example, they were rushing these things through because once you finished a plane, you got a progress payment. And when the plane was yet to be finished, there could be cash flow issues. So they were rushing these things through production, putting some of them together, missing critical spare parts, and then just hoping to kind of remember to do it, you know, before they put the thing in the air. And so he revealed that. He talked about how they were buying spare parts at huge overcharges, which was a sort of forerunner of some of the scandals during the Reagan administration. They would waste all kinds of resources. They'd have, you know, specialized equipment at one factory, and they needed it at the other factory. And instead of using what they had, they would trash the existing stuff and buy new. So there were all these internal practices that were leading to the overruns. And Durham, you know, made it very clear what some of those were. And as a result, he suffered, among other things, death threats from people in Marietta, Georgia, not directed by the company, but there was this environment at the time of, you know, we need these jobs, we don't want anybody getting in the way of that. And one of the factories apparently had, you know, banners put up periodically saying things like, kill Durham and kill Proxmire. Durham had to get federal marshals to protect him. So, you know, between Fitzgerald being essentially fired and Durham suffering death threats for his activities, it wasn't exactly an invitation to be a whistleblower. I mean, you know, he had to show quite a lot of courage to take these things on. So it was more than just a, you know, speaking truth to power. It was really taking great risks with your career and even with your safety to speak about these things.
We're talking with William Hartung. He is director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill, you had just said that it sounded like the combination of those two situations with the C-5 and the Cheyenne had put the company in a precarious situation. Did I hear that right?
Yes, they actually came to the point where they were threatening to go bankrupt, and their finances were in terrible shape because the Cheyenne was canceled, the C-5A, they had to eat some of the cost overruns, their L-1011 airliner was not competing well with Boeing and Douglas products. So they reached a point where they came to the Nixon administration and said, you know, we need help here, and they asked for $250,000 in guaranteed government-guaranteed loans. And people like Proxmire were not about to have that happen. You know, they felt like this company had earned the right to fail and that the worst case, it would be reorganized through bankruptcy. They would keep the most efficient parts of it. A lot of the production could be done by other American companies like, Boeing or the Douglas Aircraft Corporation. So, you know, Proxmire's position and that of some conservatives like Senator James Buckley of New York was we shouldn't be rewarding their mismanagement and inefficiency by bailing them out. But the flip side was arguments by some liberals like Senator Alan Cranston of California, who had a lot of Lockheed work in his state, who basically said, you know, first of all, it's a jobs issue. Second of all, this company is intertwined so intricately with the defense of the country with the other companies. They build a lot of different weapon systems like the Polaris and like the transport planes. And if they're not here to build them, who's going to do it? And so the argument emerged that, you know, they were too big to fail, much in the way that the argument about the banks in recent years, that they're too big to fail. And so there was a huge battle in the Senate in particular, and it came down to single vote margin. And the margin was the senator from Montana, Lee Metcalf, who originally was going to vote against the bailout, but he was buttonholed by Alan Cranston, who said, "Do you really want to be the one who's responsible for the loss of all these jobs?" And afterwards, Metcalf, you know, admitted that that was the clinching argument why he decided to vote for the bailout. And the New York Times did an analysis afterwards, and there was this fascinating kind of, you know, geography of the vote. Almost everybody with a Lockheed factory in their state or district voted for the bailout. A lot of places that had Boeing or McDonnell plants voted against the bailout because they figured if Lockheed went under, the companies in their states would get the business. And then the unions, there was a split between the machinists and the UAW based on which companies they worked for. And then there was the swing vote, people who didn't have either company in their districts or states. And they sort of broke down a little bit on ideological lines. Some of the conservatives said we shouldn't be subsidizing these companies. They should fail, you know, the way you would fail in the regular marketplace. And then some of the liberals viewed it as a jobs issue, like Hubert Humphrey, for example. So it was quite the fight, and a lot of it was couched in terms of really what capitalism is about. Is it about companies, you know, kind of winning on the merits, or is it about them getting bailed out by the government? And Proxmire coined the term corporate welfare during the course of this bailout debate, and he said this was sort of the ultimate example of government corporate welfare for, you know, a company like Lockheed. So they were able to get that loan, and it gave them a little bit of slack, but they still needed to sell the airliner. If they couldn't sell the L-1011, they really weren't going to be able to pay back the loan. And so it put them in a very difficult position.
And how close was this to when Chrysler was getting their bailout?
It was right at the same time, essentially. So they were the sort of the models for the corporate bailout. They're the first, you know, big major corporate bailouts of the modern era, and kind of a, you know, forerunners of some of the things we've seen lately, which of course are much on a much larger scale.
And they got their bailout.
They did indeed. But in order to pay back the money, they had to engage in unethical business practices. You know, they basically, to sell the L-1011 in Japan, for example, they hired a ex-war criminal, an organized crime figure named Mr. Kodama, who had been one of the founders of the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, who knew the heads of the airline, who basically was wired into every possible angle of the economic and political structure of Japan. And he helped distribute bribes of $1.7 million to the Japanese prime minister, to other key figures. There was a Lockheed vice president, Carl Kachian, who sort of quarterbacked this effort. And in one day, he signed off on something like $3 to $4 million in bribes. And that was just the opening gambit. And we never did find out exactly how much they spent in Japan, but it was in the millions and millions. So anyway, it worked. They got the contract. President Nixon sort of weighed in their favor, and the British Prime Minister, Edward Heath, came to Japan, lobbied for this because there was a British engine in the L-1011. And so he had two countries, you know, two leaders, two countries leaning on the Japanese to buy this, as well as the bribes. And they did similar things in Italy, in the Netherlands, in Indonesia, in Saudi Arabia. And there were some, you know, what would have been comical episodes if there wasn't so much at stake. But, for example, in Italy, they kept a little black book with the code names for the different people that they were passing money through or bribing. And there was a nickname, Antelope Cobbler, which was the nickname for the Italian prime minister. And when these books were revealed during the investigations of this by the church committee in the Senate, they were trying to figure out which Italian prime minister this was. But during the period, about 2 years, where they were using this nickname, they had been three different governments in Italy. So they couldn't figure out which of the three prime ministers was the antelope cobbler who was getting the money. But there was some correspondence within the company where they had, there had been a cycle of government in Italy. They had taken care of everybody. You know, there was like a set fee per plane for bribes. And it looked like the government was going to fall. And they were freaking out. It was like, you know, we got to get this deal done. Otherwise, we've got to start all over, you know, a whole other round of bribes. So the companies were getting played to some degree, even as they were playing the government figures. For example, in the Netherlands, Prince Bernhard ended up working both for Lockheed and for Northrop and asking both of them for bribes, both of them for various considerations, even though he was lobbying. Basically, they're competing for the same work, and he was lobbying for both sides of the competition. So, you know, sometimes they got kind of taken to the cleaners on this stuff, even though they were, you know, doing unethical practices themselves. In Saudi Arabia, they used Adnan Khashoggi, who later became famous during the Iran-Contra scandal in the 80s. And they were writing, you know, memos around the company saying, we don't know if this guy is passing the bribes on, or if he's keeping it himself, you know, we can't figure this out. And so anyway, they kept getting the deals. And so they figured, well, he's keeping it, he's spreading it around, and, you know, we don't really care as long as we get to sell the planes. And in fact, when Senator Proxmire was quizzing the Lockheed executive about this, he was trying to pin down Carl Cacci, and he said, well, you know, you can't tell me you don't even know where the money's going. I mean, if you're bribing somebody, don't you know whether it ends up with that person? And Kachin said, no, we have no idea. But as long as we get the deal, we assume that they bribed the right person. Although he didn't like to use the word bribery. They called them kickbacks because his lawyer seemed to think that that had some less injurious legal meaning in terms of any consequences for the company. So, you know, so you had them spreading money all over the world to sell the L-1011. And it was a result of some of those deals that allowed them eventually to pay back the government loan guarantees. But, of course, then they got in big trouble for the bribery itself. Several executives stepped down. Proxmire helped pass the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which was the first anti-bribery statute. Before that, bribery, at least from the U.S. perspective, was considered legal. And they actually were even able to charge it off on their taxes. As long as they used a middleman, you know, they could say, well, this is just a cost of doing business. So, you know, they were indirectly responsible for this reform, which has at least curbed the more, you know, egregious forms of bribery. I mean, people aren't walking around with paper bags full of money anymore, or at least not as often as they used to.
What happened then? We move forward to 80s, 90s, and...
Well, you know, the late 60s and early 70s had been very tough times for the company between the bailout and the bribery scandal. And then we got into the period, the post-Vietnam period, where military spending started to come down in the Carter years before the buildups that happened after the fall of the Shah of Iran and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. There was a period where military spending was at its lowest level since about 1951. So the companies were scrambling after a smaller budget, and Lockheed Martin was disadvantaged in some ways because of all the problems that it had. But then Reagan came to the rescue. You know, Ronald Reagan campaigned basically on an anti-communist theme, first against Gerald Ford, who he almost took out, and then against Carter. And he was the guy who talked about the evil empire and talked about how the Soviets essentially were sort of like 10 feet tall, and we were only 5'2", and then we were going to have to catch up to them. So when he came in, he had the biggest peacetime military buildup in the history of the country, and he doubled spending on things like ballistic missiles, which was a big Lockheed Martin product. So they, you know, their military contracts went from about $2 billion to $4 billion in a two-year, three-year period. So finally they were kind of out of the woods. You know, they were very profitable. They had a sympathetic president. But then again, they ran into some scandals that sort of tarnished their image and eventually led to reductions in the Pentagon budget.
Wow. Can you go into that a bit? How can't imagine the Pentagon budget being reduced by scandals.
Well, I think, you know, miracles happen sometimes. One of the problems they had that was revealed was they were overcharging for parts, much as Henry Durham had described in the early 70s. But these were much more visible to the public. It was things like the $600 toilet seat and the $7,000 coffee maker and the $435 hammer. And these had been revealed partly as a result of Ernest Fitzgerald, who had finally gotten his job back at the Pentagon. And he was working with a woman on the outside named Dina Razor, who started a project called the Project on Military Procurement, which used whistleblowers. But instead of the old method, where the whistleblower would risk their career, they served sort of as moles. They would stay at their jobs, and they would pass along data that indicated, you know, the nature of these overcharges. So while there were a few people who came public, there were also these kind of, you know, moles within the system, which Fitzgerald called closet patriots, who were handing out the information so they could tell about the spare parts overcharges. And, you know, Lockheed had various defenses. You know, one thing they said was, you know, it's not a toilet seat. It's the cover of the toilet seat that we overcharged for. And it was only relevant from the point of view of satire, because Herb Bloch, the Washington Post cartoonist, had this series of, you know, strips where Caspar Weinberger, the defense secretary for Reagan, had this toilet seat around his neck. And so, you know, if they had known that it was a toilet cover, there goes the cartoon. You know, I mean, maybe he could wear it as a hat or something, but it wasn't quite as compelling a graphic image. And then they said, well, you know, we buy so few of these, you know, that of course, if you're going to buy in small numbers, it's going to cost you more. And then they said, you know, it's a very sophisticated product. This isn't just a regular toilet seat. And so they tried all the various rationales, and none of them were really flying with the public or the Congress. So finally they said, well, all right, we'll, you know, we reviewed our, you know, methodology here, and actually we overcharged you $100 per toilet seat. So we'll charge you $544 instead of $642, you know, per item. And they still got this rain of criticism. Finally they said, all right, we'll give them to you for a dollar. You know, let's just get this off the table, because we don't want it to tarnish our image or undercut the larger, you know, push for military spending. And, you know, before that finally happened, though, there was an executive who did named Robert Ormsby, who wrote a piece for Aviation Week, the specialty magazine, where he basically blamed the critics. He said, well, it's, you know, it's irresponsible writing in the press. It's special interest groups, by which he meant Dina Razor's nonprofit, which had exposed this. People just want to get their names in the paper. You know, we build a good product. And, you know, most of all, it's undermining the morale of our troops. You know, so revealing that they're wasting tax dollars that could have been used to support the troops was sort of twisted around in his worldview as being something that was going to hurt the morale of the troops. So basically, you know, any criticism of the Pentagon for any reason or of the contractors, he was trying to say, was unpatriotic. And that argument ultimately didn't work either. And the spare parts controversy, along with the beginnings of the shift, the Gorbachev-Reagan rapprochement on things like nuclear weapons, did contribute to what was a downward path in military spending, which went further, of course, with the end of the Cold War. So, you know, it did come back to haunt them, although they did pretty well with them for themselves for most of the 80s. And they also, of course, were benefiting from the Missile Defense Program, which was a huge Reagan initiative.
So then you, if we jump forward to the War on Terror, is that when spending started ramping up again?
Well, they had to come up with a strategy for surviving the post-Cold War period. And so this was when Lockheed Martin was created. Norman Augustine, who ran Martin Marietta, sort of looked at the landscape and said, you know, we're going to get hit with lower budgets here. We should merge a lot of these companies. And then from his point of view, if he could build a company based on the parts of all these other companies and be the biggest kid on the block, then inevitably when military spending went back up again, he would be able to seize a larger part of that growing pie. So he was looking ahead, you know, figuring maybe in 5-6 years we'll have an upswing and we'll be in the best position to capitalize on it. And he was helped in that by William Perry, the defense secretary at the time, who basically held a meeting called the Last Supper, where he sort of said to the executives, you know, if you look to your right and look to your left, one of you's got to go out of business, you know, one of you three, because we just can't sustain this, these numbers of companies. And I recommend that you merge. And so not only did he push for them to merge, but he created subsidies. So the taxpayers were actually paying for some of these mergers, either to move factories around or, you know, decommission equipment, even for some of the bonuses and golden parachutes for the executives. Because when they merged, there were two boards of directors, for example. So some of them had to step down. And the ones who stepped down had contracts that said, you know, if you ever are terminated from service, you will get the following payment. You know, so some of the board members got maybe $250,000 each, paid for by the taxpayers for the terrible fact of not being able to go to board meetings anymore. And then Augustine himself, in the way his contract was written, this was viewed as being terminated by Martin Marietta, even though he was going to run the larger entity, Lockheed Martin. So he got about $8 million in various golden parachute payouts, and about a third of that came from tax dollars. So not only was the government subsidizing it, but it ends up Perry and John Deutsch, another Pentagon official at the time, created the policy and had been business associates of Norm Augustine. They had consulting contracts with Martin Marietta right before they went into the Clinton administration and created this policy to benefit the company. So there was a clear conflict of interest there, and there was a clear indication that this Augustine was a pretty skilled guy, because not only did he manage to gobble up all these companies, but he got the government to pay for it. So he really built the foundations of the company that we see today.
Can you talk a bit about the Lockheed Martins? In addition to being the number one contractor at the Pentagon, they appear to be doing pretty well with a lot of other parts of the U.S. government.
Well, they've branched out now. I sort of joked in one of my pieces that they're sort of the, you know, my candidate for the next Big Brother, because not only do they work for the CIA and the National Security Agency and the FBI, they helped the Pentagon run a program called the Counterintelligence Field Activity, which actually for a certain time was spying on anti-war activists and peace activists. And their work for the National Security Agency included assisting in programs that were used to intercept people's telephone calls and internet interactions. So, you know, very directly they were involved in spying. They also had hired interrogators who worked at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And then they do all kinds of information processing for the IRS, for the Census Bureau. They work for the Postal Service. They're working on the National Archives. They help train the transportation security agents who pat you down at the airport. So they run a big database on fingerprints for the FBI. So they're really pretty much all service, all-purpose government contractor now. And that's really not entirely surprising, because what they're good at is lobbying for government contracts. And so they've just applied those lobbying skills to another set of government agencies.
And didn't you also write that they were embroiled with the assassination program in Pakistan?
Yes. They ran a contract. They were sort of the manager of a contract where three companies that were supposed to be providing background information about Afghanistan, just the culture, the people, the history, not direct intelligence. It ends up they were actually generating targeting information for assassinations of people who were suspected of being Taliban or Al-Qaeda leaders. And this was being done by spies and special forces and private military employees in Pakistan at a time when Pakistan was refusing to let U.S. troops on the ground in their country. So they're trying to do an end run around that provision. And Lockheed Martin was managing the whole operation. They also make the missiles that are used in the Predator drone strikes to actually kill people. And they also provide some of the intelligence for calling in the strikes. You know, where should we aim the missiles? So they're involved in, you know, all aspects of the sort of counter-terror operations in Pakistan. And you know, I think that's another part of the company that's maybe less known than things like, you know, producing fighter planes.
Yeah, it seems to be a ever-expanding business.
Well, yes, because they also, they've got kind of, you know, almost their own foreign policy. I mean, they have a division called PAE, which originally stood for Pacific Architects and Engineers. And that company made its fortune during Vietnam, building military bases there. But they branched out into things like building bases for peacekeepers, building refugee camps. Eventually, they've done things like recruit law enforcement personnel for countries. And so when Lockheed Martin bought them, they started branching out even further. And so they were getting contracts to reform the justice system in Liberia, or they were hiring election monitors for elections in the Ukraine and Bosnia. They even had an employee, according to the Wall Street Journal, who helped write part of the Afghan constitution. So all these kinds of, it's almost like, you know, just as they were profiting from kind of the hard side of foreign policy, the weapons side, now they were getting into the sort of the softer side, profiting from diplomacy. And to kind of highlight that, they actually gave $1 million contribution to the U.S. Institute of Peace. And so here you have this body set up by Congress to promote peaceful resolution of disputes, and they're getting $1 million from the world's largest weapons contractor. And not only is it, are they going to get a, you know, recognition at the USAP's new headquarters, but they've got a lecture series sponsored by Lockheed Martin, where they'll have the Lockheed Martin logo and the programs. And this is all, you know, in part to promote these activities that they're involved in peacekeeping and elsewhere. But they're now wondering whether this is as lucrative as they hoped it would be, and that there's a possibility that they might put parts of that activity on the auction block. So we'll have to see what happens with that.
But it would seem, even if it is not financially lucrative, that it gives them incredible power to have access to all this information and control over all these different programs.
Well, yes. I mean, I think, you know, certainly to the extent that they're still bidding, they're wired in terms of inside information about what the government knows, what it's looking for. And in some areas, like intelligence, there are now more private employees doing intelligence work for the U.S. government than there are, you know, government employees. So there'll be some sensitive offices in the intelligence community where you've got contractor employees sitting right next to government employees, in many cases even supervising them. And so Lockheed Martin's a big part of that. They've been called by Tim Shorrock, who did a great book on all this called Spies for Hire, the largest private intelligence force in the world, because they have 52,000 employees who are cleared to do classified work, many of them now working in the intelligence field. And they do things like not just, you know, crunch data, but help write the daily intelligence brief for the president. They help run agents in different countries. You know, so they're really getting into the kind of active part of intelligence, not just, you know, helping them get new computers or something like that.
So you've been following these issues for many years. If the current administration or new administration that put you in charge of oversight and regulation and correction of large corporations like Lockheed Martin, what recommendations would you implement?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd go on the offensive. You know, I would just cut the Pentagon budget across the board by a substantial amount. We're spending about double what we were spending at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, and more than every other country in the world combined, and the highest levels we've spent since World War II. So a lot of that is unnecessary. We could cut 100, 200 billion a year and still be by far the most powerful military in the world. And I think if you do that kind of thing, which was done to some degree at the end of the Vietnam War, less so at the end of the Cold War, it's harder for the companies to fight back. I mean, if it's just one weapon system, they can rally their forces, they can make the jobs argument. If it's an across-the-board policy, at some point, even the lobbying power that they have is just, you know, it's kind of like you set them back on their feet and they just don't know where to start. So I think that's one thing I would like to see happen. Another is some alternative way to create jobs. And I think it's a very hard climate for that now because, I mean, you can't even get Congress to agree on extending unemployment benefits. But ideally, if you invested more in infrastructure, in green manufacturing, in other areas that have more growth potential than the Pentagon, there would be more jobs for skilled people. And some of the people who might be laid off from something like the F-22 might have options, especially if there was some sort of retraining programs to help funnel people into some of the, you know, the new growth industries. But that's probably a long-term undertaking, just given the tenor of the country's politics at the moment. I would probably take the revolving door. And, you know, a reporter said to me, you know, some people are saying make them wait 5 years before they can switch. And the advantage of that is, you know, they're really just selling their Rolodex. You know, here's who I know. And 5 years might, you know, the Rolodex would get a little stale, might not be as advantageous for the industry to hire them. So I think there are things that can be done, but it would take, you know, strong presidential leadership and then Congress to somewhat get out of the way. Because a lot of times Congress actually adds things into the Pentagon budget that even the Pentagon itself has not requested, you know, based on pork barrel arguments. So it's not an easy problem, but I think we will have some opportunities now because of the deficit. The President's Deficit Commission recommended cutting about $100 billion a year from the military budget, which would be an amazing step forward from where we are now. Robert Gates just announced he would cut about $13 billion a year, which is just chump change in a $700 billion budget. So, you know, if they're actually going to try to reduce the deficit, and this isn't just all rhetoric, then it's going to be some harsh trade-offs between military spending and everything else the government does. And I think in that climate, people will cast a more critical eye on the Pentagon, and even members of Congress may be forced to give up some of those their little goodies in the, you know, in the military field to make room for other programs that people want and need. You know, people have always asked me, well, you know, Bill, you've been doing this for 20, 30 years. I mean, you know, why do you think anything's going to change? And I guess what I would say is that there's unique moments where you've got, you know, maybe leverage that you didn't have at other times, like at the end of Vietnam, at the end of the Cold War, and military spending has been reduced. I think what we haven't been so successful at is changing the process. You know, if you could change, you know, the job creation process, if you could change the revolving door process, if you could rein in some of our commitments around the world, you know, the 700 bases we have and the commitments to go anywhere and do anything, you know, if there were changes in our strategy, be a little harder for the companies to sort of wrap themselves in the flag and say, this is why you need our transport plane, or this is why you need more nuclear weapons, or this is why you need our aircraft carrier. So I think, you know, part of it comes back to what do we want our country to do? You know, what does it take to defend the country? And if we don't need these things to defend the country and we've got grave fiscal problems, let's not do it. And I think a lot of times people feel like, well, it's beyond me. I mean, let the experts decide. I don't know how many fighter planes we need. But I think there might at least be pressure to make sure that they're spending on things we need because of the deficit problem.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Well, I appreciate the chance to do it.
We've just been talking with William Hartung. He is director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex.